Okay, this is the, welcome, glad to see you. This is the second Sunday in the series about Matthew 17 and 18. And this is the teaching of Jesus to his disciples when they gathered for the last time at Capernaum in Galilee after the Transfiguration and before he left for Jerusalem and for his crucifixion and death and resurrection. There are seven stories. The miracle of the coin in the fish's mouth, the millstone around the neck for causing little ones to stumble, gouge out your eye and cut off your hand if they cause you to sin, the 99 sheep story, what you're supposed to do before you kick people out of your church, forgiving 70 times 7, and what happens to unforgiving people. Seven stories. So I'm going to repeat some of the introductory material from last week. For those of you who have heard all this before, oxygen masks will automatically fall from the ceiling. Be sure to put your mask on first and then help the person in the seat next to you. Breathe normally. Oxygen is flowing even if the bag doesn't inflate. So last Sunday was the first in the series, and we focused on the coin in the fish's mouth story. Today we're going to get three stories. First one, the story about the millstone around your neck for calling little ones to stumble. And the 99 sheep story. And the story about gouging out your eye and cutting off your hand if they cause you to sin. So this is Christ managing expectations. He gathered his disciples to Capernaum to give them a heads up to what's about to happen to him and to them. This is Christ managing people's expectations of Messiah. So he's telling them, redemption is coming. My kingdom is coming. What's happening? Oh, how nice. He just turned on my light. That was very sweet of you, Barry. Thank you. You're very bright. And redemption is coming. My kingdom is coming. In fact, it's here. All the things you ever wondered about are going to be put right. But Christ says, first, I have to die. Which is not what they wanted to hear, and that is creating problems among them when it sinks in that Christ is not meeting their expectations. So the original audience for this discourse was Christ's disciples, who were Jewish men and didn't need a roadmap to take them back to the Old Testament and Psalms and Proverbs and details of the Mosaic Law. And you and I have to keep drilling back to get these references that they would have known instinctively, probably from childhood. So we have to go the long way around. So they had an expectation of Messiah called Second Temple Judaism that colored everything about how they saw Christ. And it directly affects us because it relates to how you and I manage our own expectations of Messiah. So Second Temple relates to Messiah, relates to Second Coming. So we're considering Matthew 17, 18 from the point of view of Second Temple Judaism expectations of Messiah. Second Temple Judaism is the Jewish religion as it developed during the Second Temple period, which began with the construction of the Second Temple around 516 BC, ended with the Roman siege of Jerusalem and the destruction of Solomon's Temple in 70 AD. So the temple built by Herod at the time of Christ was really the, where'd that come from? Was the third temple. But Second Temple Judaism is more about a socio-historical phenomenon and a mindset rather than a specific particular building. So Second Temple Judaism is where the idea of end times gets its start. The Jews at the time of Christ, including especially the disciples, get their expectations of the Messiah from that. So around the time that Solomon's temple was destroyed and then rebuilt 70 years later as the second temple, Isaiah and Ezekiel and Haggai and Zechariah prophesied a future human king who would rule and purify Israel as God's representative, its Messiah. Sometimes two messiahs. There was an idea of two messiahs, and one was the suffering servant, and the second fulfilled the traditional messianic role of a ruling king. At the time of Christ, Israel had been back from exile in Babylon for 400 years. First temple was replaced by a second temple, and again by Herod's temple, and there was a Holy of Holies and a sacrificial altar, and the sacrifices had resumed, but the bad guys were still in charge. And this time it was the Romans who were the bad guys still in charge, but they were still the bad guys. And most important, there was still no visible messianic kingdom. So what is an example of the expectations of Messiah that Christ was trying to manage? So later in his gospel, Matthew reports an incident that happened on the way to Jerusalem. And after Christ gave them heads up about things not going according to their plan, and still they didn't get it. After all this, this is from Matthew 20. That the mother of Zebedee's sons came to Jesus with her sons, and kneeling down asked a favor of him. "What is it you want?" he asked. She said, "Grant that one of these two sons of mine may sit at your right hand, and the other at your left, in your kingdom." "You don't know what you're asking," Jesus said to them. "Can you drink the cup that I am going to drink?" "We can," they answered. Jesus said to them, "You will indeed drink from my cup. But to sit at my right hand or left is not for me to grant. These places belong to those for whom they have been prepared by my Father." When the 10 heard this, they were indignant with the two brothers. Jesus called them together and said, another expectation management exercise, said, "You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them. Their high officials exercise authority over them. Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant. Whoever wants to be first must be your slave. Just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many." Now, this is a Second Temple Jewish helicopter mom promoting her kids. So the mother of the disciples, James and John, is expecting Christ the Messiah to become world dictator in time to make her kids political number one and political number two under him, like Sergei Shoigu and General Prigozhin under Vladimir Putin. That may sound preposterous to you and me, but her request is right on schedule for a Second Temple Jewish mother in Second Temple Jewish times, getting a personal audience with the Messiah on his way to Jerusalem. But what Christ says to her is basically, careful what you wish for. Careful what you ask for. You just might get it. So there was a really big difference between what she thought she was asking for and the reality of where that was going to take her two children. Christ assured her that her children would drink his cup. So in less than 10 years, James brought the gospel to Spain and returned home to be beheaded by Herod. John's the only disciple of the 12 known to have lived to old age and not martyred, but the tradition says that he was boiled in oil and survived. So who is the greatest? Hint, they don't get the corner office. So we go back to Matthew 18 at the beginning of the chapter. At that time, the disciples came to Jesus, saying, "Who's the greatest in the kingdom of heaven?" Calling to him a child, he put him in the midst of them and said, "Truly, I say to you, unless you turn and become like children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Whoever humbles himself like this child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven." So Christ says to his disciples, if you want the corner office when I get to be king, you must become like this child. And he says to his disciples, unless you turn, meaning the disciples were facing in the wrong direction. So what does it really mean to become like a child and humble yourself? And which direction are you facing? Micah 6:8, you probably know. It's a great little song goes with it. I don't think I'll sing it. Maybe Fran will sing it. She can do that. He has shown you, O mortal, what is good, and what does the Lord require of you? But to act justly, love mercy, and walk humbly with your God. We wouldn't have had to read that to the disciples. They probably knew it. Probably knew it by heart. That would have been. That's what this was meant to trigger in their minds, I think. So, okay. Riddle me this. Who is the second most humble child ever? I'm going to vote for Isaac. Isaac the patriarch. Because he willingly walks for 3 days, and there's that 3 days thing again talked about, with his father Abraham to the altar of sacrifice on Mount Moriah, which is where the temple ends up being built, where Isaac is the sacrificial offering. The child sacrifice was common among the Canaanites of that time, as it is in our time, but we call it abortion. There's no account of Isaac trying to run away or get out of this. But at the last moment, the angel of death stands over him, ready to plunge a knife. Isaac is delivered from death by a substitute sacrificial object, a ram, the sheep that shows up, gets it tangled up in the bushes right behind him. So Abraham sacrifices that one. The angel of death stays his hand, which happened later with David when he tried to take a census, didn't collect the tax that Jesus collected for himself and for Peter by the fish, coin in the fish's mouth. Remember, we talked about that. The angel of death stayed his hand because of the sacrifice on the altar at Mount Moriah. That's where the temple went. It's all dots connect, and the disciples would have instantly done that. So let's say Isaac the patriarch, second most humble child, the first most humble child ever, is Christ himself. He's the Old Testament Son of Man. He's the New Testament Son of God. He walked humbly to the altar unto death as a substitute for you and me, and he's delivered after 3 days by resurrection. That Christ is the Son of God is the greatest child in the kingdom because he is the most humble. Whoever wants to be great among you must be your servant. Whoever wants to be first must be your slave. Just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. See, Christ is also God. So who in all the universe is more humble than God himself? He speaks to people in words. He makes contracts with people who can't possibly hold up their end of the deal, and he holds it up for them. Psalm 34 says, "Magnify the Lord with me, and let us exalt his name. The humble shall hear thereof and be glad." A friend of mine was talking about, over here, that guy right there. We were talking about extraterrestrial life. And there are so many worlds out there that it's just impossible to wrap your mind around. And it seems logical that there must be something going on. But one thing we know for sure about this world, you can forget all those other worlds, this one is in rebellion against the Most High God. And it has been. It's been rebellion against its creator. There are other worlds out there. We don't know what their status is. You know, green men or whatever. But we know that this one has been in rebellion. And the humble God has not destroyed it. He continues to invite us back to the place where he started. That's how humble he is. So when we say, "Magnify the Lord with me, let us acknowledge his name together," the humble shall hear thereof and be glad. Who's the humble one? Made glad. When you and I magnify the Lord and exalt his name together, Christ is the humble one, and he is the one made glad. Okay, now, how do we receive one such child as this? Back to Matthew 18, verse 5, "Whoever receives one such child in my name, receives me." So who is the one such child that Christ is referring to, and how do you receive such a child? Well, I could be wrong, but I believe that Christ isn't talking here about children in Sunday school. He's not just talking about Sunday school, at least. Let me suggest that maybe he's talking about something much bigger. What's about to happen to Christ as the most humble child of God, the Old Testament Son of Man, the New Testament Son of God, when he gets to Jerusalem, no one will receive him by that name. I think he's talking about how to receive himself and how to receive Christ in his own name, meaning as he is, the humble suffering servant, and at the same time, sovereign Lord of all things, not two messiahs, just one, the whole package. Okay, children and millstones. Chapter 18, verse 6, whoever causes one of these little ones who believe in me to sin, it would be better for him to have a great millstone fastened around his neck and be drowned in the depth of the sea. So there's a tendency to conflate Matthew's references to children, I think. For example, in a few more chapters, he relates how the disciples tried to shoo the kids, and he rebukes them for this, or at least they didn't connect the dots same way. So I think the little ones in this passage are the people who receive the one such child as Messiah in his own name, humbly, meaning without imposing their own expectations of Messiah, whether it's disciples themselves or anyone else who believes in the Christ, the suffering servant, as sovereign Lord. So the millstone fastened around the neck is an Old Testament reference to things a creditor cannot take from a debtor, someone who owes him money, to collect the debt, no matter how big that debt is. According to Moses in Deuteronomy, it's taking someone's millstone to collect the debt is like taking his life by starvation. You can't grind grain, you can't make bread. So here's a spoiler alert. We've got seven stories going, three more to go in the next 2 weeks. The last one's about debtors and creditors. What happens when creditors forget that they too are also in debt? Okay, how about gouging and cutting off? Yeah, that's Matthew 18, verses 7 and 8. Woe to the world for temptations to sin. It's necessary that temptations come, but woe to the one by whom the temptation comes. If your hand or your foot causes you to sin, cut it off, throw it away. Better for you to enter life crippled or lame, with two hands or 2 feet, be thrown into the eternal fire. If your eye causes you to sin, tear it out, throw it away. Better for you to enter life with one eye than with two eyes, to be thrown into the hell of fire. Okay, now Christ quit preaching. He's come to meddling. Woe to the one by whom the temptation comes. So who is that? Well, Christ is telling them, if your hand or foot causes you to sin, if your eye causes you to sin, not somebody else's, not the devil, you are the one by whom temptation comes. So I could be wrong, but I believe that when Christ said this to the disciples about woe on the one whom the temptation comes, and who would be better off without their hands or feet, they would have remembered what he taught them earlier in the Sermon on the Mount from Matthew 5. You heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you, everyone who looks at a woman with lustful intent has already committed adultery with her in his heart. If your right eye causes you to sin, there it is again, tear it out and throw it away. For it's better that you lose one of your members than that your whole body be thrown into hell. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. For it is better that you lose one of your members than that your whole body go into hell. So this is Christ quoting from Deuteronomy in the Sermon on the Mount, and he's referring it to again. The disciples and any other educated Jew would have connected those dots. But you and I need help. So there it is. Now think, there is more that they would have known and that would have connected the dots from Deuteronomy. You shall not do according to all that we are doing here today. Everyone doing whatever is right in his own eyes. And from Proverbs, Every way of a man is right in his own eyes, but the Lord weighs the heart. In the Sermon on the Mount, those hearers would have connected those dots. So there are temptations to sin that bring woe to the world, but those temptations come from the heart inside, not from the world outside. Like what he said about food, contamination uncleanness doesn't come from the food, it comes from the eater. Your hand, your eyes. So if it's your own right eye and your own right hand that lead you astray, then what do you got? Well, we got worthless shepherds. I'm going to talk about worthless shepherds. Back to verse 7. Woe to the world for temptations to sin. It's necessary that temptations come, but woe to the one by whom the temptation comes. Anderson causes you to sin, cut it off. I cause you to sin, tear it out. Better to be crippled or lame than two hands or 2 feet cast into the eternal fire of hell. All of this comes out of Old Testament prophecy. Severing the foot, poking out the eye, is the judgment of woes from the Old Testament prophecy reserved specifically for worthless shepherds who don't look after their sheep. Zechariah 11. Woe to my worthless shepherd who deserts the flock. May the sword strike his arm and his right eye. Let his arm be wholly withered and his right eye utterly blinded. Disciples would have connected the dots. In Ezekiel 34, the word of the Lord came to me. Son of man, prophesy against the shepherds of Israel. Prophesy and say to them, this is what the sovereign Lord says. Woe to you, shepherds of Israel, who only take care of yourselves. Should not shepherds take care of the flock? You eat the curds, you clothe yourselves with the wool, slaughter the choice animals, but you do not take care of the flock. You have not strengthened the weak, or healed the sick, or bound up the injured. You have not brought back the strays, or searched for the lost. You've ruled them harshly and brutally, so they were scattered because there was no shepherd. So this applies to religious leaders who don't do their job, particularly the people the disciples were about to meet in Jerusalem, who weren't going to receive Christ as Messiah. Part of the heads up. Okay, the 90 and 9. So we come to the 90 and 9, which is about what people should expect of the suffering servant and sovereign Lord. We go back to Matthew 18, start at verse 10. See that you do not despise one of these little ones. For I tell you that in heaven their angels also see the face of my Father who is in heaven. What do you think? If a man has 100 sheep and one of them has gone astray, does he not leave the 99 on the mountains and go in search of the one that went astray? And if he finds it, truly I say to you, he rejoices over it more than over the 99 that never went astray. So it is not the will of my Father who is in heaven that one of these little ones should perish. Now, the reference to the 90 and 9 comes from what we just read in Ezekiel 34. The disciples would have recognized this right away as part of the promise to Second Temple Jews from Ezekiel about what they would rightly expect from Messiah. Ezekiel 34, continuing, that this is what the sovereign Lord says, I myself will search for my sheep and look after them. As a shepherd looks after his scattered flock when he is with them, so I will look after my sheep. I will search for the lost and bring back the strays. I will bind up the injured and strengthen the weak, but the sleek and strong I will destroy. I will shepherd the flock with justice. So there's a problem with sheep. Worthless shepherds start out as precious sheep, who turn out to be worthless sheep, and predators against one another. Continuing, Ezekiel 34, as for you, my flock, this is what the sovereign Lord says, I will judge between one sheep and another, between rams and goats. Is it not enough for you to feed on the good pasture? Must you also trample the rest of your pasture with your feet? Is it not enough for you to drink clear water? Must you also muddy the rest with your feet? Must my flock feed on what you have trampled and drink what you have muddied with your feet? Whatever you might say about worthless shepherds, how sheep get to be worthless comes from the sinful heart within every sheep. Sheep forget what the faithful shepherd does for them. Still in Ezekiel 34, therefore, this is what the sovereign Lord says to them. See, I myself will judge. Good, we get rid of that. I myself will judge between the fat sheep and the lean sheep. Because you shove with flank and shoulder, butting all the weak sheep with your horns until you have driven them away, I will save my flock, and they will no longer be plundered. I will judge between one sheep and another. I will place over them one shepherd, my servant David, and he will tend them. He will be their shepherd. The Lord will be their God. My servant David will be prince among them. I, the Lord, have spoken. See, any sheep can become a fat predator sheep who deserves a millstone around his neck for what they do to others. The sinful state of all sheep is that they all stray, and the shepherd has to bring them back. But Christ, the faithful shepherd after David, is prince over all of the sheep, and he seeks out all of the strays, including the sheep who cause the other sheep to stumble. So Matthew is the one telling this story. He's all of these gospel stories. This is his story that he wanted you to know. See, Matthew is the resident legal and tax expert of the inner circle of Christ's disciples. Mark and Luke refer to him just as Levi, son of Alphaeus, which is why we can make an educated guess that Matthew was born a Levite, meaning he started out burdened by other people's expectations. He had a generational assignment to the priesthood. But in his gospel, Matthew the apostle refers to himself just as the tax collector, which is what he was doing when Christ sought him out. He would have been prepared to be a priest from his earliest days. He was schooled in the Mosaic law more than any of the disciples. But then he broke bad. He became a tax collector, meaning he defected to the Romans, used his education to work with them and collect the temple tax and their other taxes, because the Romans were the ones who collected the taxes. He went over the dark side. So if that's right, then Matthew couldn't have gotten any further from his upbringing than where he ended up. He is the sheep on the mountain that this story is all about. That's why he wrote it. And that's why he wanted you and I to hear it. But he's talking about himself. So the 99 is not just about bringing back the sheep who left Sunday school because the shepherd was unfaithful or some other sheep, bad sheep, ran him off. It's about bringing back the one who causes the other sheep to leave Sunday school in the first place. The sheep with a millstone around his neck. I guess he's easy to find. Anyway. So true humility teaches us that any of us could fall into either category. And at different times of our life, we certainly do. But we do know, we don't know exactly when that is or what. And perhaps you're carrying with you a regret of what you said or you didn't say, and you're looking at the trajectory of someone else's life and you feel responsible. Well, you need a Savior, don't you? And what has been promised to you? That the prince over the sheep will tend to you. He will tend to them. He will deal with their straying and with yours, because he's prince over the sheep. The one with the millstone and the one without. And I can tell you, the millstone gets passed around, but it's the same prince over the sheep. That's it. No more. See you next week.